In Chicago police body cam videos, Steele said she was a Cook County politician and got arrested anyway.
In the end, I'm not a politician. I'm a messy person. I'm a normal person.
And ICE agent shot Gonzalez after he allegedly attempted to flee in his car.
People have been clamoring for 8 months saying, can we at least have some sort of local investigation on this?
I would say to State's Attorney Burke that if she doesn't want to investigate, step aside.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Police reform advocate Anjanette Young is a step closer to a seat on Chicago's Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. Tickets for Juneteenth and beyond come and go at the Obama Presidential Center, plus a push in Springfield for stronger guardrails around AI.
Illinois lawmakers are trying to decide what should happen when artificial intelligence leads to serious destruction or even death.
We really need to establish where the guardrails need to be.
Mayor Brandon Johnson in Springfield making another push to keep the Bears from leaving Chicago.
Johnson opposes a mega projects bill that would allow the Bears to negotiate flat payments in lieu of property taxes.
The bulk of the conversation about Springfield right now is about how do we provide benefits for corporations.
If we don't have a bill on the table that allows them to commit to Arlington Heights, we've got the Hammond Bears.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but let's start today's episode with a look at the world of sports. With me to discuss is Chicago Sun-Times reporter Mitchell Armentrout. He's one of our panelists this week, and when he's not covering politics, he spends his days at the ballpark following the White Sox. Hey, Mitch, good to see you again.
Great to see you, Sasha.
So the White Sox are off to a much better start this season than past years. This is really exciting.
Very exciting. It doesn't look that exciting on paper. The Sox are 17-20, two games back in the AL Central. But that might not sound impressive, but you couldn't say that about the White Sox. Not since 2021. It's been 5 years since they've been this close to being just about okay.
Yeah.
Not like we're not talking championships yet, but we're talking respectable baseball, which is an upgrade.
I'm curious what you think made the difference.
The difference this year, there's a player named Munetaka Murakami, who
is hearing that name a lot.
A Japanese slugger, new to Major League Baseball, and he's one of the major league leaders in home runs so far. Names like Aaron Judge, Cal Raleigh, he's up there with them. And he's has shown no signs of slowing down. Mm-hmm. He's really kind of proven himself to be – he's got the makings of a superstar at this point. I mean, again, it's still the first month and a half of the season, so there's plenty of times for things to go the other way that the White Sox are more familiar with. But things are looking up in early May.
Off to a good start. Off to a good start. And we want them to keep this momentum going. So tell me what you'll be keeping your eye on in the weeks to come with the Sox.
I am really keeping my eye on this little budding baseball bromance that we've got on the South Side with – our guy Mune, as he's known, and Colson Montgomery is the White Sox budding star shortstop.
Oh,
they had a cute little like sushi eating celebration after they hit a home run last week.
Oh, that's so cute! I gotta go back and watch.
Mune took the team out for a sushi dinner, so this was after that. So things are fun, and like the vibes have been pretty bad, just to put it flatly.
Yeah.
So it's been a good time.
All right. Well, thank you for the update, Mitch. Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Carrie Shepard, Chicago reporter with Axios, and Jake Sheridan, City Hall reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Now, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson headed south. He made his way down to Springfield this week, so Jake kicked things off by telling us what was on the agenda.
Every May, the General Assembly has to pass their budget by the end of the month, and so it's time for the mayor of Chicago to go down and push for a couple of things. So, I got the one pager from the mayor in front of me right now.
All right, tell
us.
Some
of the biggest things were pushing for a kind of long shot bill to raise taxes on the wealth of billionaires, a statewide digital ad tax, and the governor's budget would cut the city slice of the local government distributed fund. So basically the slice of state income tax that goes to cities.
Mm-hmm.
It would shrink it. The mayor doesn't want his slice of the pie to shrink. He wants a nice big piece of pie. So those were some of the top priorities for the mayor in Springfield.
I'm curious what kind of reception he got.
I'm curious what Mitch has to say about that.
You know, this is the third time Brandon's gone down to Springfield, and he just doesn't really have much clout down there. Hasn't really managed to build up some of the relationships that, you know, former mayors like Rahm Emanuel, former Mayor Daley, Lori Lightfoot also never really made many inroads in Springfield. So, yeah, I think the other part of this, too, is like it's May 8th today. The session ends in 3 weeks. Like, these are conversations that really you want to have start several months ago. So not terribly optimistic that a lot of these boxes are going to get checked, but we'll see.
Well, speaking of conversations, lawmakers, I mean, they've got until the end of May, as you mentioned, to also hammer out this stadium bill, right? What are they considering to try to keep the Bears in this state?
So the idea behind this mega project legislation is that it lets big companies that are making big investments negotiate smaller payments instead of their fully assessed property tax bills. The Bears need this because if they were to build out in Arlington Heights, you know, in the next couple of years, their property tax bill would be like over $100 billion, like not feasible really for any company. So the problem with that is that, you know, folks probably around here know that their property tax bills are going up too. And there are a lot of Chicago legislators and elsewhere who say that we shouldn't be helping out big companies, big professional football franchises, unless you can help out regular folks too. So that was the idea behind this House bill that passed last month. Basically, you would split the payments that these big companies would make. Some of that money would be diverted to property tax relief funds for regular residents. The problem with that is that the governor's office ran an analysis, and it might save the average person like a buck or two on their bill.
Yeah.
So really not any meaningful relief.
Not what we thought it was going to be. So I want to get everyone's thoughts. Does it seem like Chicago is definitely off the table for the stadium location?
I mean, it does, actually, to be honest. I mean, the Bears want to own the land. They don't own Soldier Field right now, so they want to own the land. They want to own the stadium. They want to build this stadium, big stadium park like we see in other cities.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem very likely. And as, you know, nobody, including the mayor, wants the Bears to leave Chicago, but it just doesn't seem like there's a feasible path right now when the mayor, as a progressive, wisely is not going to say, yes, give the Chicago Bears a multi-billion dollar corporation
right,
a tax
right.
cut, while no politician who ever, we don't know if the mayor's running for re-election yet, but no politician who ever is going to run for, that's the third rail. They're not going to say, yes, let's hike up the property taxes.
You know, it's interesting. He's the last person who's saying it's possible. And it's interesting to think about what that would take. It would take a lot of subsidies from the city or from the state to get them to stay in Chicago. I mean, billions of dollars. And that's going to be a hard sell, like you're saying, for a progressive. So
what about Indiana? I mean, is that a real option, Mitch? And are people, do you think they're starting to come around to that possibility?
I think at this point, there are a lot of fans who really don't care all that much. The thing is, like,
I see so many conversations where they're like, well, it'd actually be closer, especially Southsiders.
And
right?
Southsiders is
so much closer for me to get there.
It's, like a, like a 20-minute drive right now from Soldier Field.
Right.
You know, 95% of people are watching football on TV. The thing with Indiana is, like, it's almost too good of a deal to say no. Like, it's truly, like, an offer you can't refuse. Like, they have passed so many new taxes on Indiana residents that would essentially pay for this entire stadium. The Bears would get to keep all the money that it generates and then get to buy the stadium for a buck in 40 years after the lease is paid off. The more rational side of me says that the site they're looking at is literally an old industrial dump. It's surrounded by federal Superfund sites. It's across the street from an oil refinery. Like, you can generally, like, you can literally, like, smell oil being refined.
Right.
Like, it's not like
sure.
It's not like the idyllic football setting.
It's not the current view you have at Soldier Field.
Right.
Yeah,
it's a long
Lake
ways from that. So
I think also, Mitch, sorry to cut you off. I think that, like, this is probably a small percentage of Bears fans, but there are people who maybe don't agree with the politics of Indiana that may say, wait, I don't want to give my money to Indiana. Now, caveat on that, lots of people already give their money to Indiana, like you said. They cross over and have for years for lower alcohol taxes, cigarette taxes,
so many
gambling.
Things.
Yes, for sure. For sure. But that could be a small percentage that would maybe push back a little on that concept.
So you alluded earlier, Carrie, to just sort of what this could all mean for Mayor Johnson. I'm thinking, Jake, about the fact that this mayoral election is, what, less than a year away. We're talking February 2027. You're already looking at the potential candidates and the money that they've raised, right? People already sort of throwing their hat in the ring or flirting with the idea. What have you found?
It's amazing how much money is piling up behind Alexi Giannoulias. And I think it's really important to talk about who it's coming from. It's coming from you know, billionaires and trades unions in particular. Mm-hmm. And there's a clear intention behind this money. It's a flex. They're trying to get other people who aren't Mayor Brandon Johnson out of this race. You know, people like Congressman Mike Quigley, Susana Mendoza, a bunch of others, because everyone and their mom wants to be mayor in the city. But, you know, that's the clear takeaway right now. There are a lot of people who have a decent amount of money. Folks like Alderman Bill Conway, again, Quigley and Mendoza are serious fundraisers and would be able to run a serious campaign if they do officially get in. Everyone's still in the flirting phase.
Yeah.
But it's almost time to move beyond flirting.
When do we think Johnson's going to actually say?
I would bet, you know, I think he's running. I really do think he's running. I think the whole idea that he isn't from some people who oppose him is kind of silly. If I were him, I'd probably declare in like July, August, you know, end of summer.
Yeah. Interesting.
Will you say how much Janulius has, please? Because it is
it's a lot.
Astonishing.
It's like $20 million or 18 close. Now? Yeah.
Like, that is a lot of money.
It's so much money.
It's a lot of money.
And it's going to be so much bigger.
Let's go back to Springfield, Carrie, because just like everyone else in the country, Illinois lawmakers, they're debating AI.
Yeah.
So talk to me. What are they considering?
Well, there was a joint committee hearing, subject matter hearing this week on Monday with tech industry bigwigs. And by bigwigs, I mean like there was a representative from Anthropic there. And the idea is that more guardrails around AI, which is something we hear a lot, right? We hear a lot about, oh, they're going to take our job. Or, the robots are coming. you know, AI is going to take our jobs, et cetera. But the issue that they were bringing up is that in recent years, we've heard about these tragic incidents of people, not just young people, but people dying by suicide after communicating with a chatbot. And there have been major lawsuits against AI giants on this. And these lawmakers are saying, look, you all need to put very serious safety precautions up. But then also there needs to be third parties who can audit these AI, you know, developers because you guys aren't self-regulating, essentially. Now, the big people like Anthropic are going to say, yes, of course, that's what we want. You do have some of the opposition to this is coming from people who say, well, this is going to push out the little AI guy, right? This is going to, we're not saying don't regulate, but don't over-regulate so that we can't compete at the same level. AI is moving so fast and government moves so slow. Somehow there needs to be you need to bridge the gap there of like, as the technology is going to keep advancing, the legislation has got to stay on top of it. So that was a big back and forth this week at the subject hearing, subject matter hearing. And then also there's a bill that says it would treat AI. There's a few bills rather, but there's another bill they talked about is it would treat AI like a product. Mm. So you have consumer protections around it like you do a product. Well, it's not a toy. It's a dynamic thing. So putting those guardrails around it might be a little more difficult.
Oh, so complicated. Another bill that they're looking at, Carrie, this one is about how car insurance rates are set.
Yeah. Back to Alexei Janulius, our Secretary of State. This has been something his office has been pushing. It's this driving change campaign. And his office has been talking to residents across the city for almost a year now about how car insurance rates are set. This is a big thing nationwide, to be honest. And I read something this week that actually Illinois are in the lower, we're maybe in the lower part of car insurance rates compared to other states. But there's this issue of considering what could be, you know, considered discriminatory factors in deciding someone's car insurance rate, age, zip code, and rather than just, you know, your driving history. Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen this. Like, I've lived in neighborhoods in Chicago where, you know, you move one block over and your car insurance rates go way up because there are more carjackings
there. Yeah.
So, you know, I remember that for sure. But I mean, the idea is that you would strip away some of that. The insurance giants are like, whoa, hold on. So we're not.
I bet.
Yeah. But this has been a big push for Secretary of State Janulius.
For some time, yeah. Let's take a look, Mitch, in other news to changes being proposed to a statewide agency, the Illinois Gaming Board. So first, I want you to help us understand exactly what this agency is in charge of before we dig in.
So you got the Gaming Board, which is a regulatory agency, basically polices the 16 casinos that are live in Illinois, as well as all the video gaming terminals that you see out in suburban restaurants and bars and things, and probably soon in Chicago, maybe later this year, barring any basically barring the backlog that is before the gaming board, it's basically been a perennially understaffed and overworked agency. Governor Pritzker is, as part of his budget proposal, is suggesting merging the gaming board with the racing board, mm-hmm. which is another regulatory agency that's responsible for policing all two of Illinois' surviving horse racetracks.
What are the two? I don't even know what they are now that Arlington's closed.
Hawthorne is still running Stickney, despite massive financial troubles. And also, I think it's now called the FanDuel Racetrack.
Of course
FanDuel has its name on this track down in Collinsville near St. Louis.
Yeah, yeah.
So way downstate.
Way down south.
So, Jake, Chicago Alders, they weighed in on a gambling issue this week as well. Get us up to speed on that.
Well, you know those little machines in the gas station that people are glued to and that people are gambling on?
Yes, people. People are glued to.
Yep. Those are...
yeah, those not
are,
me.
Not me. Those are called sweepstakes machines, and they operate in a legal gray area where they pay out these coupons, like gift cards, not cash. It would be illegal if they paid out cash, although it will soon be legal for those same machines to be in bars and restaurants all over the city because aldermen approved them. So as aldermen move forward in approving the soon-to-be legal becoming legal video gambling machines, they want to outlaw these sweepstakes machines. So those people with the new legal machines can I guess, you know, carve up the money that would come to them, the folks that are gambling like that. So,
Oh boy. And Mitch, you've got an update on Chicago's long-awaited riverfront casino.
Right, Bally's Casino. Which
we haven't talked about that in a minute. What's going on?
And they're none too thrilled about any of the sweepstakes machines.
Yeah.
They hate it.
No, they're not.
Hate it.
Yeah.
All kinds of gambling options. Last week, they had a topping out ceremony, which is a construction thing that I was not aware of. But basically, it's like when...
what is it, like the last bit of dirt?
It's the last support beam at the highest points of the building. So
it's going up. It's,
drive over by Chicago and Halsted, it's getting big up there.
It's getting big.
Still not clear when it's going to open. Probably sometime early next year, they're finally saying.
Okay.
But a lot of hurdles still yet to come.
But they're still on track.
It depends on which track you're looking at, I guess. It was first supposed to open sometime midway through last year.
Then the
deadline was later this year.
Oh, boy.
The biggest hurdle is that they actually, under state law, are supposed to cease operations at their temporary casino in September. They need to change. They basically need to get a law passed in the next 3 weeks to keep that one running while they finish the permanent one sometime by next year.
Right, yeah. You don't want that to end in September and then there be a... gap.
Right. That's loss of tax revenue for the city. All kinds of folks would be upset about that.
Speaking of construction projects, though, the City Council's Zoning Committee finally met again after, 3 months?
Yeah.
Jake, remind us, what was the holdup again?
So, long story short, there was this massive, everyone in the City Council wants a committee chairmanship, and there's a big fight over the Zoning Committee chairmanship. And the person who was holding it in the interim, Alderman Bennett Lawson on the north side, eventually said, I'm not going to do this as interim anymore because there are resources like staff and whatnot that come with being the permanent chair. So we stopped holding meetings, didn't have one in January, caved in February, and then didn't hold one for a couple months. City Council finally picked someone to permanently lead the committee. It actually wasn't Alderman Lawson. Last second, there was a little switch up, and Alderman Gil Villegas is the chair now. And he held a meeting to kind of clear the backlog. He's going to have another one. There was this big old backlog, and it's important that zoning changes pass in the city. It's how construction happens.
Right.
You know, there's all these different things that need to happen. So
tell me some of the projects that Alders finally waited on.
There are so many. Let's see. I know my colleague Quinn Meyer wrote about a lot of these. Dozens and dozens of projects. He wrote that there are, you know, 700 plus apartments at three different West Loop developments.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
State Police, they're investigating the fatal shooting of Silverio Villegas Gonzalez, who, if we recall, he was killed by immigration agents during Operation Midway Blitz last fall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Department of Homeland Security said that Villegas Gonzalez intentionally struck one of their agents. But Carrie, that official account, like that's long been disputed, right?
Yeah, there were some discrepancies there. For one, immediately DHS put a statement, I covered that shooting, that, you know, the officer that you know, hit a shot. Villegas was seriously injured. But then there was body cam footage that came out where he said, oh, I'm fine, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. So there were disputes on that. This was really early on, if you all remember, in Operation Midway, but so early that, like, you know, DHS officials were like blaming Chicago police, and local reporters were like, wait, hold on, Franklin Park is a suburb. That's a totally different
place. Whose jurisdiction is this?
Whose jurisdiction is this? Which is, that is what gets us to today. Franklin Park was saying, look, we heard from the federal government that they were going to investigate this. They've made no movement on that. We're mm-hmm. going to ask the Illinois State Police to, because nothing has happened with it, which, like, you know, I mean, this new investigation is a win for many people who want to see some sort of accountability for everything that, you know, DHS and CBP did during Operation Midway Blitz. You know, we don't know what's going to come from it. I mean, very well, they could rule that DHS was in their rights, but there needs to be some sort of investigation on these multiple killings that we've seen now over the last 8 months.
Yeah, well, you know, as you pointed out, the investigation was launched because of findings from a state commission calling out federal agents' conduct. I want to play a little bit of what Governor Pritzker had to say about their findings.
These hearings and investigations demonstrated that Operation Midway Blitz was not an unfortunate collection of errors in judgment or limited abuses of power by individual bad actors. It was a carefully orchestrated, coordinated effort that started with Donald Trump.
So what happens after the Illinois State Police finish this investigation?
Well, we don't know, because there's this other side issue that people want a judge to select a special prosecutor to look into DHS's officer's behavior here during Operation Midway Blitz. Mm-hmm. That judge should decide, I think our colleagues reported, by like Monday, May 11th. Now, if the Illinois State Police find that there's wrongdoing in this and there is a special prosecutor, will that special prosecutor take the case up? Mm-hmm. You know, police can investigate, but then it has to go to prosecutors.
Does it get turned over to Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke in the meantime?
Well, we don't know yet. In the meantime, yes, probably, if there's no special prosecutor, if she decides that she's going to pursue it. But like, as her office has said, as she has said repeatedly, you all need to investigate, then we need to prosecute from there.
Because she's come under a lot of criticism, to Carrie's point, for not prosecuting agents and holding them accountable for their actions.
Right. She's under a lot of pressure from a lot of, I mean, basically local officials. Mayor Brandon Johnson made a big push last fall, I believe. He signed this executive order trying to outline a procedure for Chicago police to submit information to her office, just kind of, which more than anything, was like a public nudge to like, hey, maybe you could take one of these agents to trial. We haven't seen that happen yet anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the first kind of turn of the wheel.
She pushed back against the mayor on that executive order, too. And, you know, I think it just shows that, you know, again, how cautious she's being here. She really doesn't want to have this responsibility. I mean, it would lead to a ton of federal scrutiny and, you know, a lot of big questions on her office. So.
Yeah, as Carrie pointed out, the judge who's supposed to rule on that special prosecutor has said she hopes to have a decision by Monday. So we'll definitely be following up next week.
Yeah, I mean, there is always just, I would say, a little bit of question of how much teeth there is when it's the federal government is involved. As we've seen, a lot of DOJ's cases have fallen flat. But still, if mm-hmm. you hand over this to DOJ and you say DHS officers were in the wrong, what are they going to do about it is a big question.
Yeah. Relatedly, there's also news of four Chicago protesters filing a lawsuit over how they were treated during Operation Midway Blitz. They're suing the federal government over DNA samples collected and maintained in a database after they were arrested outside the Broadview ICE facility. And they allege the cheek swabs violated their Fourth Amendment rights. Now, Jake, sticking with oversight of law enforcement, Anjanette Young, that's the victim of that botched police raid at her apartment back in 2019. She may soon be serving on the Civilian Oversight Board for the Chicago Police. She spoke to Alders this week. What did she have to say?
Well, you know, she was approved by the City Council's Police and Fire Committee for that seat, and she still needs to get final approval. So she's well on her way here. But what she told them is that her experience facing that botched raid doesn't make her unfair. It actually makes her a particularly valuable person to do police oversight, because she's had that experience and she's worked with police since then to try to help reform the Chicago Police Department. She's been the leading activist in the city against no-knock warrants, the same kind of warrant that mm-hmm. that harmed her. So, you know, there were some Alders who pushed back against her.
Yeah,
and
three
cited,
voted against her, right? Yeah. Why?
Well, you know, each of them, or at least two of them, cited that they just don't like the CCPSA in general. They think there are too many police oversight boards. You know, they kind of wanted to puff out their chests and prove that they're pro-cop. But, you know, I think some of them also argued, in particular, Alderwoman Silvana Tabarez argued that Angina Young is unfair. She argued that different statements she's made in the past don't show the level of respect for police that she thinks that person needs to have.
Well, let's hear from Anjanette Young herself. I talked with her last week on In the Loop. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say about the importance of civilian oversight of police.
The community deserves to have a say in what is happening when it comes to police accountability and police oversight, because the community is the one that has been harmed by some of these bad policing practices.
Yeah, so, you know, as you were saying, folks are saying she's a valuable person here with experience and insight to lend to that.
But. Yeah, and I, you know, I want to add, too, she was generally very much approved by the city council. You know, there were a couple of people who were criticizing her, but there were as many people who were saying, you know, she's a great addition. I think of, you know, Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor and a couple others made you know, speeches supporting her. So
and had positive things to say. Carrie and Mitch, I mean, she has become such a vocal police reform advocate.
Absolutely.
I think rightfully so.
Yeah, Jake hit it on the head. I mean, to sort of insinuate that she has a conflict of interest because of, I mean, you want people on this board who do interact with the police, bad or good, so they understand what kind, that's the whole point of this commission is, you know, to check to the checks and balances of police. And Tabarez, others, those are pro-cop, you know, cop-heavy areas, which they often push back on more oversight. They're sort of the mind that the cops can, you know, can regulate themselves type of thing.
Right.
So, but yes, Anjanette Young has become a very vocal, powerful reformer after this awful thing that happened to her, which even the police agreed was a terrible thing. This led to, yes. And so to say that there's a conflict of interest, I think that is not maybe going to go so far as Jake said.
Any thoughts, Mitch?
I would just echo what Carrie said is like, you know, we cover a lot of really horrible things in Chicago media. Yeah. And her case was really, I mean, what a dehumanizing situation. Yeah. It really is, just as someone who hasn't really covered her case that much over the last few years, really a story of empowerment. Just to see her kind of rising to this level.
Yeah.
Who is a social worker by background, right? Yeah. So she already has this sort of public service, you know, that's her career.
Correct.
So it would seem to make sense.
Jake, one last item involving police and government oversight. Mayor Johnson announced his nominee for the next Chicago Inspector General, basically the city's government watchdog. And we also learned about the former Inspector General, Deborah Witzberg's new job. So fill us in.
Yeah, so the mayor appointed David Glockner. He's served a bunch of different positions in the public and private sectors. Most recently, he was a top internal investigations attorney for Exelon, ComEd's owner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he'll be coming in. He's taking the spot of Witzberg. The mayor and Witzberg, not really best friends. Not best friends.
No,
they did not get along very much.
I didn't get a clue of that.
Well, he said on your show, he criticized her. He argued that she politicized the office. And what she did, you know, the inspector general doesn't really have a ton of power to enforce different things they investigate. They can investigate. They can't really say what comes next.
They just give recommendations.
Yeah. So a lot of the power of those investigations comes from going to the public. And she did that regularly, including with investigations into his office. He often did not follow her recommendations. She would argue that he resisted her investigations. And she talked to the media a lot. And, I think that's one thing to look at as Glockner comes into office. Will he have the same relationship with the public, or will he kind of be a little quieter as he investigates the city?
Yeah. And so Deborah Witzberg is now, what is she doing now?
She is moving to Attorney General Kwame Raoul's office. She'll be his chief of staff. So she's still in
I think she's already started.
Life. Yeah.
I think it was May 1st.
Yeah.
Wow. So what a shift.
Yeah.
So we just talked about Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. He shared news this week as well, Mitch. This was about an opioid settlement.
Right. Illinois is in line for almost $149 million as part of a nationwide settlement between, I believe it's all 50 states, and Purdue Pharma, which was obviously the pharmaceutical company that really was one of the key drivers of America's opioid addiction epidemic. This money is basically going to be paid out to the state over the next 15 years, but most of it's going to come in the next few years. And yeah, the idea here is it's, you know, trying to make up at least a little bit for, you know, the last couple decades of lives that have been ruined in Illinois and abroad.
Any more specifics on where the money will go?
So that money is all earmarked for addiction recovery and treatment programs. And the state is actually, I believe, is earmarked for more than $1 billion over the next decade or so, just among settlements with other pharmaceutical companies that also have admitted wrongdoing as far as just overprescribing painkillers like OxyContin and kind of downplaying their addictive qualities, resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths nationwide. Opioid deaths are actually finally on the decline a little bit in Cook County. It was under 1,000 last year.
That's what I saw. I'm so glad you reported on this, Mitch, because I completely missed this. And like, it is astonishing that we are still dealing with this. You know, this has been going on for at least a decade.
Yeah.
And like you said in your story, you know, they've gone down, but then we saw a little spike during COVID, right? And with fentanyl, which is like, this is just, it's led up to fentanyl now. And so all this money for rehabilitation is fantastic if it does actually get to the right people.
In other news, Jake, Samantha Steele, that's a Cook County tax official and member of the Board of Review, was cleared of a drunken driving charge. Remind us of the details of that case.
So this was in November 2024. Steele crashed into a couple other cars when officers pulled up. You know, you can see it on body camera footage. She is disoriented. She does not follow directions. She has a bottle of wine open in a bag in her car on the passenger side. And, you know, police who testified at trial and those in the videos said she smelled of alcohol. They said she was drunk. She did not take a field sobriety test. She kind of weaseled her way out of one. And, you know, she said she would, and then she said she wouldn't, and then she said she would.
And then is found not guilty.
Yeah, she went to the hospital, didn't get a blood test. So, I mean, like, this is a really tricky case where, you know, the prosecutors weren't able to prove that she was drunk, but, you know, the evidence wasn't there in part because she didn't follow instructions from officers at the scene. So I was in the courtroom and it was just really interesting to watch all those videos and see that. But, you know, the judge who decided it was a bench trial, it was not a jury trial, the judge decided there wasn't sufficient evidence. So she's argued she's been treated unfairly by prosecutors. They wouldn't have prosecuted anyone else for a drunk driving case like they prosecuted her with several witnesses. Mm. She's argued the media has been unfair to her, too. I think it was an interesting case. I was, it was surprising to watch all those videos.
Now it'll be behind her, it seems. Mitch. A longtime aide to Congressman Danny Davis has been charged with fraud.
Yeah,
do we know about this?
This is one of these crimes that, to me, kind of falls under the category of, like, weird nostalgia. Because he's facing charges of obtaining about $31,000 in unemployment insurance benefits early in the COVID-19 pandemic. The problem with him claiming that unemployment insurance was that he was employed by Congressman Danny Davis's office as his deputy director in the district on the west side and south side. It's a job that he's held for more than a decade. He'll be arraigned next week. We've seen thousands of actually city employees, state employees, in addition to normal everyday residents who kind of taken advantage of
a lot of COVID era fraud.
Right. Fraud. It's kind of fascinating to think, like, I never really thought at the time, but there are a lot of enterprising folks out there, allegedly.
Did he lose his job?
That's a great question. I believe that's still being determined.
Got it.
Before we take a pause, Carrie, I want to highlight a story that you had this week about a federal investigation into Illinois schools.
Yes.
What's this about?
The Department of Justice is looking into like 36 schools across Illinois, including a charter network, Noble, that we know, a large charter network here in Chicago, saying that they're investigating. This is what the release said. I asked many, many times for clarity, and I did not get it. I was told to just look at the release, which said that they're looking into these schools for teaching, quote unquote, gender ideology, but also whether, of course, which has been, you know, an issue with the Trump administration that continues to look into whether mm-hmm. transgender students have access to facilities that, you know, adhere to their gender identity. And when I asked why these schools, what's the connection? Because they seem very geographically and demographically diverse. Again, they didn't tell me. And it seems in the sources I talked to that the schools aren't really clear either. The problem, well, lots of problems there, but the issue being that, you know, there's federal funds at stake. These are schools that, as many schools do, get mm-hmm. federal funding through Title IX. And if indeed they're violating whatever the DOJ says they're violating, they could be losing those funds, which is, you know, depending on the size of a district, is could be very detrimental.
We've been here before, though, right? The federal government using their funds to...
I have been here and are continuing to be here.
Yeah. Now, we like to focus on Chicagoland and Illinois in the news recap, but our friends in Indiana made national news on Tuesday in their primary. Republican incumbents who opposed redistricting lost big to Trump-backed candidates. How big of a win was this for the president?
It was definitely a flexing of muscles for the 47th president. Like you said, last fall, Indiana Republicans basically pretty soundly rejected the redistricting plan that the president was really pushing hard for to try and win a couple more Republicans congressional seats in Indiana. So President Trump backed seven challengers to those incumbents who voted against him. Mm-hmm. And at least five of those have won. Another race might still fall the president's way, too. So a pretty resounding victory and just kind of a warning shot to other Republicans in other states that, hey, if you go against my wishes, I'm going to come after you pretty hard.
That's the thing. I mean, does it seem clear, Jake, that despite the president's low approval ratings, he still holds a lot of power over Republican
voters?
It's
amazing how much the party is centered around him. You know, he's the guy. He controls it. And, you know, I think it's a really interesting choice, too, by the president to focus so much on these internal politics instead of trying to become more popular across America. Mm-hmm. Republicans are going to need that in November if they want to win. And, you know, doubling down on, you know, the most kind of radical and control-based parts of his party— it's an interesting choice. I don't know if a lot of voters are going
to
like it.
Counterpoint, the Dems also maybe need to stop talking about Trump. I mean, everybody talks it. They're just doing his backers a favor. Absolutely. They start
I'm
every,
not him.
Yeah. Exactly. Instead of here's what I am. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn from our current president to a former president. So after 5 years of construction and many, many more years beyond that of planning, tickets for the Obama Presidential Center went on sale this Wednesday. All the tickets, though, that first month, they sold out within hours, folks.
I was going to think it was, I thought it was going to be like minutes.
Minutes, right?
Yeah, like I thought it was going to like crash the
like
site,
a Beyonce sure. concert?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, the center officially opens to the public on June 19th, which is Juneteenth. It's got a range of activities that are going to be going on throughout that weekend. I'm curious if any of you have been inside the building yet.
God, no. I've been trying and trying and trying, but I have not gotten in yet. I do know of people who have.
Yeah, they've, I mean,
there's
so
been
do we.
Some sort of soft launches for certain people. So that's great. But I don't think I'm going until the media preview in June, early June.
Definitely. Our Sun-Times colleague, Lee Bay, has... course gotten the
very jealous of
the
Lee.
Up close yeah. and personal Lee, exclusive
Lee
tour.
Should. He
Lee
should.
Is,
come
Lee
on.
Is special.
He, yes, absolutely.
Lee is very special. Who's excited to experience it? It's almost here.
I'm so pumped up. You know, that's like I like mostly learned to read by like reading about
from Barack Obama,
the like 2007 and 2008 campaign. Like that was like I was like obsessed with it.
Oh
it was
my god,
like,
I feel so old.
It was like my thing. Sorry, it was my thing as like a little kid. I just was obsessed with politics.
That's so wait, Obama taught you to read?
In a sense.
I love that. Now you're a politics reporter. That's awesome.
Yeah,
you know.
So, yeah, Jake. This guy is. I mean, he's just so big in how we view American politics, even if he's not popping up every day like he used to, right?
But yeah. Also, there's a library branch there. There's a huge outdoor space, which I'm super pumped to see. Like, if you look at the renderings, it's pretty incredible.
Yes.
How it's taken over Jackson Park, which is one of our most beautiful parks by far. So I'm excited to see that mm-hmm. for sure.
General admission tickets for Illinois residents will be $26. $15 for children under 12. Tuesdays are free for Illinoisans. Ooh. What do y'all think of this, the price range here? Expected?
Yeah, that seems expected.
Reasonable?
I mean, yeah. I I don't know what museums cost this day because I usually go as a reporter yes. and or I'm a member at most of the museums. So.
Or you used to live in D.C. where you went to Smithsonian Museum
yeah,
for free.
Right, right. No, but I like that they have a free for Illinois residents. That's in line with what a lot of museums do.
Any other thoughts
wise.
on what this could mean for the South Side and surrounding neighborhoods?
I'm excited to see, yeah, like is there actually like a real economic boost to yeah. the area? You know, there's obviously a lot of consternation in the planning phase, whether that part of Jackson Park really needs much more of an economic boost. Maybe that could have been more more sorely needed in Woodlawn. But obviously, we're well past that. It's really fascinating architecture. It's a beautiful area of the park. So I'm excited to have that section reopened.
Yeah, me too, for sure. I want to take the conversation over to the western suburbs. Strike at the Brookfield Zoo has come to an end. After 3 days, zoo and union officials were able to find some common ground for a 4-year agreement. So now we kind of get to the portion of the show where we sometimes talk about what's new or what's notable with local media. And we're often discussing bad news when it comes to talking about local news, unfortunately, but not this week. This week, we've got something to celebrate. And Jake is looking at me. I'm looking at Jake. I want you to do the honors. Tell us what's going on.
We at the Chicago Tribune won a Pulitzer Prize this week for local reporting. Yeah, it's so exciting.
So well-deserved.
You know, I'm just so proud of our newsroom and the work that we all did during that time. It was the most important time that I've ever been in a reporter for. And, you know, like, that's what this work is all about. Moments that are hard like that and stepping into them. You know, I was talking to someone last night. It was like game 7, you know? I just think everyone in our newsroom showed up at every different level. Everyone's got to share in it. And, you know, everyone in Chicago media did such amazing
yes,
work. And
agreed.
I think it was reflected in how the city made up its mind on what it thought because
yes.
it had information. It knew that, you know, frankly, the federal officials were lying often.
Yeah,
and
let's clear it up for folks.
People.
You won this Pulitzer Prize at the Tribune for your local reporting on coverage of Operation Midway Blitz.
Yes.
Right? As we all know, the Trump administration's aggressive enforcement mission last fall in this city. And, I mean, it was just standout journalism.
Amazing. Amazing. From the get-go. Sorry, Jay. I mean, and sometimes too, some of the photographs sometimes photographers took, I thought were definitely Pulitzer winning.
Honorable mention
yes,
to our
absolutely.
Team
absolutely.
Here.
But
absolutely.
Just like Greg, Laura, like all these at the Tribune, they never stopped, which was amazing, even though DHS was coming personally for them. Yeah. And it just showed. And also, I would just say something I think we all do well, and we continue to do. They talk to real people affected.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just take what DHS said, and that I thought was just really, really critical and great. So it's amazing. So proud to know you guys.
Yeah, I want to read what the Pulitzer Board had to say. They said they honored the Tribune, quote, for its powerful coverage of the Trump administration's militarized immigration sweep of the city that described in vivid, muscular prose how the siege-like incursion of ICE agents unified Chicagoans in resistance.
Totally.
Again, kudos to you folks.
Thank you.
Jake and team. I also want to quickly touch on some other news that involves the owner of the Tribune, Alden Global Capital. Now, Crane Chicago Business reports that the company is in advanced talks to acquire the city's major suburban paper, which is the Daily Herald. So if the sale is completed, it would give Alden, which we know and have reported on for its deep cost cutting, it would give Alden control of 2 of the 3 largest newspapers in Illinois, which is, I think, pretty major. I mean, what do you think this means, though, for the public?
Nothing good. The Alden playbook is very well known. They scoop up newspapers and other media organizations that are doing really good work, in some cases profitable work, which is really rare in these days. And what they do is they just start hacking away and sort of slowly suffocating the editorial resources, shrinking jobs, not filling positions, just kind of letting things sort of wither on the vine, which is a real shame, especially in an age where we need accurate journalism more than ever, I would argue.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of great reporters at the Daily Herald.
Yeah.
It's the current ownership agreement is like we were talking about. It's a complicated employee-owned sort of arrangement with the retirement fund. But a lot of Chicago's best journalists have gone through the Daily Herald.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're still doing some of the most important reporting in the region. Very concerning.
Yeah. Carrie, what comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, the Daily Herald is critical, as Mitch says. And as we were talking before, all of Jake's colleagues, like the Tribune that started at the Herald. And actually
a lot of them.
Mitch started at the Herald. Several people at sometimes BZ did. I mean, this is the suburbs, you know, we get city centric. Some of us, probably all of us, live in the city. And I read the Daily Herald all the time to make sure I'm not missing all the critical stuff happening in the suburbs, because mm-hmm. let's not forget, the suburbs are not just extensions of Chicago. They're their own communities, places like Aurora, Arlington Heights, Naperville. I mean, these are huge communities.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of stuff going on and at every level. And they need to also, there needs to be accountability for their leaders there. It's not just how the suburbs affect us here in the city. So, I mean, keeping the Herald around is essential.
Jake?
You know, I think of what happened in our newsroom the month before all that Pulitzer winning work. And it was a layoff. We had a layoff in our newsroom, and it was the worst experience of my career. I was our union's president, and I had to make a lot of really tough calls, and I had to try to fight it, and I couldn't win. And it was amazing to see the newsroom then, editors and reporters and photographers, rally and produce work that I am so proud of. Mm. But that work happened in spite of those cuts. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that it's bad to shrink newsrooms. It harms people so much. And I think the suburbs are some of the most undercovered areas of this city, of this state. So I really hope that no cuts happen. There is a playbook here, as Mitch said, but I really hope that the hardworking journalists at the Daily Herald can keep doing their work.
Well, we got about a minute left, folks, so why don't I check into what you're working on next week? Mitch, what's on your plate?
Not to bore you more, but obviously, like most other Chicago reporters, or an unfortunate cohort of Chicago reporters, we'll be watching for Chicago Bears stadium news.
Oh, boy.
Could be a critical week. We'll see.
You're also watching the Sox, who are doing well.
That's
Sox
right.
And Cubbies are doing well.
The Sox would be a bigger story, except the Cubs are like even hotter. It's a good time for baseball in Chicago.
Yes, yes. Jake, what's on your plate?
I am still really interested in this mayoral election. I'm trying to figure out like how... what's happening in back rooms right now, if people mm-hmm. are pushing each other out. So I think that's really interesting. Also interested in some of the fights about bike lanes and pedestrian road remaps, especially on Archer Avenue and Grand Avenue. So looking into those.
Oh, yeah, I should probably have a conversation on that soon. It's always lively when we talk.
Absolutely.
Anything motorists, anything bikes, it's the most calls,
most
tweets.
For sure.
Whenever I want to talk to an impassioned politician, I'm like, hey, Alderman LaSpada, can we go take a bike?
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Carrie?
I'm staying on this DOJ story, hopefully unraveling a little bit more on that. But may I just add really quickly, because WBZ listeners would know very well, that Cheryl Ray Stout, your sports contributor and someone we know and care for deeply, is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Lissagor Awards tonight. And just kudos to Cheryl.
Yes.
She's incredible. She's a trailblazer. Yes. So congratulations.
We're so proud
of
Cheryl.
Yeah.
That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Carrie Shepherd, Jake Sheridan, and Mitchell Armitrout. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sasha.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.